Well, okay. So here we are. At last, having once again dodged the bullet of the mystery of technology. I'm glad to be here. I'm extremely glad to see you all here. So we'll begin as we usually do, and I'll go through a couple of emails, and then I'll talk for a little while, and then hopefully you will talk for a little while too. Hi, John. I recently discovered you online searching for something on YouTube. Anyway, you immediately caught my attention, and I've been watching videos, listening to podcasts, and reading what you've written over the last 2 weeks or so, and of course trying to self-inquire whenever I remember. For me, the inquiry involves basically using my attention awareness to feel for my ego, which usually seems to be a ball or unpleasant knot of fear and unacted upon chronic panic in my stomach and maybe chest. I feel that fear has been there so long that it doesn't even need to give a reason for its existence. It doesn't need to give a reason to be afraid. It's become a part of my body, just like my heart, my lungs, my kidneys, etc. Actually, I don't believe it's always there, and it certainly alters in intensity. I figure those feelings in my body must be an effect of believing the lie, as you say, because they certainly seem to be tied up in the belief that I am at stake here. Please feel free to comment on anything I've said here. Whenever I try to think of a question, it seems contrived and unnecessary, so I'm not going to ask one. That unpleasant knot of fear that you find in your chest is what, I don't know how familiar you are, of course, with Ramana Maharshi, but one of the things that Ramana Maharshi advises people to do, and that this has been extremely useful to me, was extremely useful to me back in the day. He advises people, and I want to be I want to qualify this a little bit, what I'm about to say, because he uses the term ego, and the term, he doesn't use the term ego, he's spoken some language, I'm not sure, Hindi or something, and what was translated, whatever it was he said was translated as ego, and I, for those who have been with me for a while, I am very, I'm not too much in love with the word ego because of the baggage it carries from psychology, from psychiatry, and from just the popular culture in which ego is used as a pejorative, a way of saying that's bad. You're in your ego, or you're an egomaniac, or and all those things. So in any event, I think ego is a pretty much useless term. It means literally I in the Latin, and so I don't use it very much. But that, what you speak of is this unpleasant knot of fear and unacted upon chronic panic in your stomach and chest. This is what Ramana refers to, is referring to, or at least what I thought that he was referring to, what I came to conclude he was referring to, when he makes this really bizarre suggestion that we, if we think ego is the problem, we should get ego by the throat and hold on to it and not let it go and look at it directly and without the, as much as possible, without the understanding we have of what this knot is, like a knot of fear and so forth. It's just a sensation. It's a sensation that we try to avoid and try to get rid of, and much of our effort in the life as we try to create a satisfactory identity is actually an effort to placate and get rid of that that knot of claustrophobia and fearfulness and anxiety and so forth that you refer to. This is a common experience. It may be the experience of all humans when they, if they look for it. Ramana, or I heard, what I heard Ramana advise was to rest attention on that knot of unpleasantness and hatefulness and fearfulness and worthlessness and so forth, to put attention directly on that with the idea in mind of actually having the direct, unmediated sense of it, the unmediated, ununderstandable taste of it. The what you can expect, and this is not not in order to understand it or to get a better idea of what it is or to know it to be ego or not to be ego or anything else. It's merely, as is pretty much everything that I speak about when I ask people to do things, it is the actual raw sensation of it that we're after, not the understanding of it, not the comprehension of it, not the elimination of it even. Although, what happens when attention rests without agenda, apart from experiencing, when attention rests on this knot of claustrophobic and fearfulness and confusion and so forth, what generally is the case is that it disappears. And the usefulness of this exercise in the practice of the vichara is that when that knot of claustrophobic fearfulness and stupidity disappears, what remains is you. And the only purpose and the only point of the vichara is to bring the personal consciousness, the tool of personal consciousness, which is focused attention, in direct contact with you. The vichara is to look at yourself. And the usefulness of bringing the attention to that knot of unpleasantness is that when it goes away, all that remains is you. Now, of course, as with all of the efforts in the vichara, the capacity to maintain focus on anything is limited for human consciousness, so that you focus on this knot of unpleasantness, it disappears. What remains is you in direct contact with you, and then sooner or later, sometimes very quickly, sometimes after a while, you'll find that your attention wanders away to other things, and that's okay. Because the only thing that counts is the time when you bring personal consciousness in direct contact with reality, which is another name for you. So, I hope that's helpful. That's the point of that component, that element of the vichara, the component or element of bringing attention to what feels like ego, what feels like the problem, what feels like the afflicted one, the victim, and so forth. It's not in order to ease its pain and suffering. It's not in order to understand it or comprehend it. It's just in order to go through it and get the direct contact with the actuality of you. Okay. Here's another email. As I listen to you speak, I hear a familiarity, a likeness to myself, and whether it matters, it resonates. It eases something in me, some chunk of ego that says, not me. A point of uncertainty is that if you make no distinction between me, I am, self, etc., then can inquiry just as readily be ego inflation as self-realization? Will ego not take the opportunity to masquerade as truth? You see, here's the thing. Let me continue because there's more in the next paragraph. While my experience is one of having glimpsed truth, I've become steeped in the observation of the subtleties of mind, its tricks and evasion, its discovery of the range of possible escapes of the very truth it seeks, and then its indulgence of those escapes. I recognize that whether I observe the processes of mind or turn my attention elsewhere, strategies and the observation of strategies both appear and disappear. It may be a habit I refer to be compelled by something or nothing no more significant than any other bodily function. Yeah, right. It is no more significant, even less significant than bodily functions. It is just a habit. It really has no meaning. And here's the thing to understand. This natural, perfectly natural inclination of the human mind to find support and confirmation for its own importance and its own role in escaping from misery and suffering and fearfulness and so forth. This perfectly understandable, perfectly natural and ordinary trait of the human mind is entirely beside the point to the vichara. It is certainly true that ego, whatever ego is, if there is such a thing, it is certainly true that the human mind is endlessly trying to mimic or become reality. And it does so driven by the same underlying confusion, chaotic confusion, that is endlessly bubbling up from this underground certainty, this underground conviction, this underground belief that I'm at stake here, that I'm trapped here, that I am in danger here, that it's possible that I can find salvation or redemption or transcendence here also. But that I must do it exactly right. I must get everything exactly right. Otherwise, I am doomed here in this life, in this body, in this mind. None of the things that the mind does in order to, and all of the activities of the mind, as it turns out, all of them, everything whatsoever, is driven by this underlying need to either create or discover a satisfactory, stable, solid identity. All of that activity is beside the point of the vichara. The point of the vichara is to look at yourself directly. The point of the vichara is to look at yourself directly. And when you look at yourself directly, there's nothing there to be seen, which is, of course, is what gives rise to the stories about our essential inexistence and so forth. But there's nothing there to be seen because what you are in reality is invisible. It is the light of awareness. It is invisible. There's nothing to be gotten in the meeting of human consciousness with its source. There's no fruit there. There's no understanding there. There's no clarity there. What there is there is reality. And the bringing of human consciousness, tormented and tortured by its endless efforts to create a stable identity, The the contact with reality of that human consciousness gradually over time eliminates this false belief that you're trapped here, that you're at stake here, that you're in danger here, or subject to salvation and transcendence here. The point of the vichara has nothing whatsoever to do with the direct interference with the crazy activities of the mind or even the sane activities of the mind. The point of the vichara is to rid us all of those who partake in it, to rid of us of this underlying, unseen, unseeable, incomprehensible, inferential belief that I'm in danger here, which is the cause of all the problem. So, don't worry about it. It may be that in the practice of the vichara, it may be that the mind goes off on all kinds of trips and strategies and reactions and attempts to take control of and all of those things, but none of those things can hurt you. The essential certainty of reality is that nothing whatsoever can hurt you. Nothing can take anything from you. Nothing can give anything to you. You are absolutely unchanged and unchangeable. You cannot be hurt or helped by anything whatsoever that comes and goes in the mind. And you can't be convinced of that. What can happen is that which stands in the way of the clear seeing of that, the clear natural seeing of that, can be wiped out by bringing mind, human consciousness, in direct contact with reality, which is you. So the vichara is much simpler than we think it is. Everything is much simpler than we think it is. And the vichara in particular. It's not a spiritual practice in the normal sense of spiritual practices that are designed to transform or transcend the insanity of the human mind. It is a practice that is designed for one purpose only, and that's to bring the light of truth into this darkness that is the belief that you're at stake here, on the line here, to snuff out that belief. And when that belief is gone, many changes come. Many changes come to the personality, many changes come to the way the mind operates, but over time. Over time. Continuing with this email, I've listened to teachers who place subtle blame on the mind that refuses to stop. In probing that mind, I've gone from arrogance to the knowledge that I am the worst of sinners to seeing that so are we all, which makes my negative inflation less compelling, and to the recognition of holding back that seems infinitely able to be more subtle, more slippery, which itself might be nothing more than the belief that I must get to the bottom of it, that if I don't, everything is my fault, and if understanding is the chance to redeem this life, as I write the words, it seems more that this is just one application of the mind's general activity. Yeah, precisely. You know, of course we project these things on those whom we have assigned the role of teachers in our life, but it's really we who do that. We who place not so subtle blame on the mind that refuses to stop once we've heard what we think is the command to stop. Of course we do. We place horrifying blame on the mind that refuses to stop. We probe the mind looking for what we can do to make it do what it's supposed to do. We look at its sleaziness and its subtlety and its endless tricks and magic potions, trying to make it something that we think it should be. But of course, that's what we've been doing all along in our endless, unconscious, and unseen effort to create and stabilize an identity that's not at risk. To create and stabilize an identity that is safe and true. And the same thing applies once we start seeking a spiritual solution and find what seemed to be the instructions to still the mind, that the mind is the problem, that the life is the problem. This is a deep misunderstanding that runs through the whole world of spiritual discourse, this unacknowledged understanding even, this unacknowledged sense that it's the mind that's the problem. The mind must be changed. The mind must be fixed. The mind must be killed. The mind must be stopped. The life must be turned into something that won't harm me. Vichara doesn't have any interest in any of that. The Vichara truly doesn't have any interest in doing anything at all about the mind, apart from ridding it of this unseen, invisible disease. That is a belief that I'm at stake here, that this life, this mind, is the problem and the solution. All of that stuff can go on and continue to go on while the vichara goes forward. There is a great inertia within mind, within human mind, and the structures and habits and strategies and tactics that it's developed over the years to protect itself, to protect me, seemingly. None of that, all of that, is beside the point of the vichara. All of that will shift and change and adjust itself and settle into a new outlook, a new point of view in time as that belief is snuffed out. Years ago, the email goes on, I read reference in a sutra to monks dropping dead at the words of the Buddha. This was my entry into the recognition of unconscious fear, of calling it forth and the observation of its suppression and of the intricacies of mind in its capacity for subterfuge. Do I need to do, can I do, something about this? I don't know what to do or not to do. You neither need to do anything about it, nor do you need to stop anything from being done about it. I tell you from my heart, I promise you from my heart, that all that's needed is to, as often as you can, bring your human consciousness, your human conscious attention, looking for you, looking for what it is to be you. What are you? What does you feel like? What does I feel like? Where is it to be found? None of these questions are of any use to you except insofar as they bring attention in contact with reality, which is an event that is, well, literally unremarkable. There's no remark that is made of it. There's no notice of it whatsoever in the conscious mind. You don't need to worry about it. I promise you that if you strive earnestly to look at yourself, that you will see exactly what I'm talking about, and that in the end, over time, all that causes misery and suffering in you, all the swirl of all of the investment in doing something about the swirl of mental activity and mental misunderstanding and mental subterfuge and mental subtle evilness, all of that will reveal itself to be of no consequence. And as it is revealed to be of no consequence, it will change. Lastly, in this email, when others say they are like me, I harbor doubt. I've been in prison, lived in poverty and failing health, unable to meet the basic needs of my family. When you say it, there's no uncertainty, not only because of the similarity in some of the details, but because of the way you speak, as well as what you say, which, far from being too much, creates the resonance that elicits this response. But when you speak of truth as pertaining to me, in quotes, I don't know what you mean. That all, in quotes, means all I can see, and yet distinctions assert themselves. Will you speak to this, to the me slash I of it all? Well, I'm not sure that I entirely know what it is that you'd like me to speak to. The me slash I of it all. What I say, what is plain to me, so plain to me, is that the distinctions that are made between the different personal pronouns, even second and third person personal pronouns as opposed to first person personal pronouns, that those distinctions are all distinctions without a difference. They are matters of context only. They point to no substantial reality whatsoever. I am you, and you are me, and we are all together. And that's true enough for the sake of this. When I say you, I could just as easily say me. When I say me, I could just as easily say you. And I, well, that covers it all. All things, all creatures can say I. And it's the same I. And it's the same you. And it's the same me. And it's the same we. And it's the same they. The heart of it all is to be found in the heart of you, which is not any physical heart or emotional heart or spiritual heart either. It is the rock bottom reality of you, which is solid as a rock, which never changes, which you have never had an instant in your entire life of not seeing. And it is that rock-solid bottom of you that I speak about. And the contact with that snuffs out the false belief, all belief about what you are and what you are not, and all fearfulness and anxiety. Hope that helps. And lastly, but not leastly, you said in the meeting today that it wasn't about not knowing what we are that's the cause of all the trouble, but the inference that we're at stake in this life. But the settling of the issue of identity means to me that I don't know what I am. I thought the problem was that I thought I am this life. That's what you mean when you say you think we're at stake in this life, no? Okay, I know what I am. I am completely able to move my attention to me, and yes, that is the medicine and nothing else matters. Simple. This identity thing confuses me, though. Me being at stake in the life means I have to get it right, and I'd better be careful that my life stuff is important. That's if I think I am this life and nothing but. Yet if I know that I am the constant whatever that the life stuff springs out of, and not the actual life stuff, that it can't be gotten right or wrong, is that not the goal? Not knowing that I am here, and the life stuff is there and everywhere, and that both can't be helped or changed, but the persistent need to fix or change is still present. The investment of me is still within me. This seems like the middle of the road to me. and the teaching of moving my attention to me as often as possible causes me to fully realize that I am that source the life springs out of and stabilize there rather than be afloat in and out of sort of straddling this reality. And the being afloat gets the mind all riled up in its variety of ways, which is why you teach to calm that down and help. Arg. I want to say something. This brings something up that I really want to clarify because I don't think I've ever really succeeded in clarifying it exactly. And I probably won't today either. My facility with words being as lacking as it is in this context. I'll get back to this email, I promise. There's a point of view and it may even be mostly unacknowledged and unseen. I mean, it's one of those things like the belief that I am at stake in this life. It is not seen, but it's always here and it has its effects. Except that, of course, it's a much more limited realm in which I'm speaking here. There seems to me to be a point of view that runs through spiritual discourse, that runs through the relationship between spiritual teachers and spiritual students, seekers, those seeking a spiritual solution to the core problem of human life. And that point of view, there's probably a lot of them, but the one I'm talking about right now, that point of view is the point of view that, and I'm not exactly sure how to say this, the point of view that the teacher, the anointed one, and most of us are self-anointed or anointed by default by the fact that you're listening to us, the point of view that the teacher in the spiritual discourse knows everything in the sense of knows exactly in words and in understanding and in a clear communicable sense, knows everything, that there is nothing that interferes with the teacher's ability to speak clearly about what they see and about what they are trying to bring to us. This point of view is kind of dumb, really. You know, I mean, those who are seeking a spiritual solution and feel that they have not found it, and those who are trying to help us who are seeking a spiritual solution and feel that we haven't found it are equally human. By which I mean equally at the mercy of, in trying to communicate, at the mercy of the limitations of vocabulary, context, cultural understanding, and the habits of a lifetime in the verbal understanding of what it is they see. In other words, the fact that the false belief that I am at stake in this life, the fact that that is gone, in no way guarantees that the apparatus through which I can speak to you is, and in fact it absolutely is not the case, that that apparatus is suddenly enlightened and all of its old ways of seeing things and speaking about things, understanding things and communicating things and so forth, that the apparatus that does that is wiped clean, and all of a sudden everything is, every word that drops from my lips is like the Word of God, like the best possible way of saying something about this that is impossible to speak about. Now, the possibility in this relationship, the possibility in the relationship between the teacher who seeks to bring an end to misery and suffering to those with whom he is speaking, he or she is speaking, and those who are seeking to get something of value from that relationship and from that communication. There is a possibility for us to see that this is a two-way thing. I speak to you, and as I see over time what you hear from me, my own capacity for communicating evolves and develops and changes. The way I said things 10 years ago is much different than the way I say things now. I mean, really much different. The inertia of the apparatus, the inertia of the concepts and cultural understandings and vocabulary and all of that that prevailed then, much of that is gone now. Directly as a result of being in these meetings with you, in this relationship with you, in this conversation with you over the last 10 years or more. So that it's often the case that I, as my ability to communicate clarifies, it's often the case that what I said before I see to be not wrong, but maybe containing ideas and concepts and communications that I see now were not as clear and not as simple and not as directly to the point as they could have been. I see with absolute clarity what it is that I try to communicate to you. It's the seeing is clear, totally clear. The effort to try to communicate that to you in the transition between the seeing and the speaking, the only tool, the only apparatus I have to work with is this mind, is this life, the vocabulary that's here, the cultural understanding that's here, the context in which it all appears, and so forth. And I, even as I speak about this matter to you now, I can see that I am not actually clearly saying what it is that I want to say. That probably I'm saying too much. Probably I'm trying too hard. But I really would like to get this point across, and if I continue trying to do it, there's no doubt that I'll get better at it. The simple point of it is that what I said yesterday is not necessarily what I say today. But what it is that I see that I am trying to communicate by speaking about remains absolutely the same. And this whole kind of not so effective effort to talk about the fallibility of the human communication that passes from the teacher to those who are seeking to get some help from the teacher. This of course comes up because of the issues that are brought up in this email that I just read concerning the issue of identity. I have begun speaking about this matter as the issue of identity rather than misidentification, for example. I see very clearly and actually have always felt uncomfortable with anything I said that seemed to connote the idea that the problem was some false identification with the life or with anything at all. The false identification is not the problem. false identification is easily seen through. Of course, when I speak with you in these meetings, or when I speak with you in this context, in the context of the effort to bring to you the value of the vichara, the identification, the persona that speaks to you in this way is much different than the persona that goes downtown to the grocery store and talks to the clerks in the checkout line and so forth, and much different than the persona that watches TV with Carla, and much different from the persona that plays with the cat or cooks dinner or any of that other stuff. These are all different personas. There's not a problem with that. Of course, we take on different identities, different identifications, different personas, depending upon the context in which we find ourselves. So, therefore, it is, in my view, inaccurate to speak of misidentification as being the core problem of human suffering. It's not misidentification. It is this deep underlying need to create an identification, an identity that is true, stable, reliable, and effective at serving what is true. Mostly that is effective at saving me from being killed in this life, whether psychologically or physically or in any other way. The problem is that deep driving need to endlessly pay attention and to as the email says, my being at stake in this life means I have to get it right, and I better be careful. It's that's the problem. It's not the identities, that the personas that we try on in order to make that happen. That's the symptom of the problem. This effort that is endlessly in progress to try to identify what's good and what's bad, and to hold on what's good and to get rid of what's bad, and put off until tomorrow doing anything about the indifferent. It's this endless driving need to create an identity that works, an identity that is me, for God's sake. It is the effort to make misidentification real that causes the problem. It's not the misidentification itself. It is the investment in identification that's the problem. It's the deep driving conviction that I had better do something to get an identity, an identification that's stable and right and true and reliable and dependable. So I no longer talk about the problem being the belief that you are your life. I see that expression, and it took a while for that to break for me. You know, there's in everybody there is an inertia to old ideas that project them into the future for quite a while, a kind of inertia. And that old idea that misidentification is the problem is huge in the spiritual world, in the spiritual realm. And it affects everyone in the spiritual realm, teacher, student, passers-by, everyone. But I don't say that anymore, because I have seen that it's much closer to the heart of the matter to understand, if there is anything to be understood, understand this, that the problem is something that there's absolutely nothing you can do about through the means of understanding. That the problem is a belief that burst into being in the moment that consciousness burst into being for you. It is an inferential belief that underlies it all, that I'm in danger here. I don't know how I got here, I am trapped in this life. I am trapped in this body. I am trapped in this mind. I am subject to the insanity, the craziness of the mind and its thoughts and its endless attempts to escape or to become what it's not. I am confused and I can't understand what to do about having suddenly found myself trapped in this life, trapped in this circumstance, trapped in this body. That's the problem. And that problem, since it is a belief, is a unseen, unseeable belief. It's an inference from the chaos of sensation and experience that bursts upon us at birth. The only thing that can be done about that belief, you can't talk yourself out of it. You can't persuade yourself of it. You can't even see it. There's no way you can get your hands on it. The only thing that can be done about that belief is to bring it in contact with reality. And this too, of course, is just a manner of speaking. It's a metaphorical manner of speaking to bring this belief, to bring human consciousness into contact with the light of reality. That's just a manner of speaking. And it may be, pray God, that the day will come when some better way of speaking about it occurs to me. Because, you see, what I want more than I want anything, the only thing that I want remaining in this life is to bring everybody in a way that can be heard and acted upon, this great good news of the infallible work of the Vichara in bringing an end to human misery and suffering and aggression and greed and hatefulness and fear. And the only way that I can do that is to get better at my job, which is, well, doing that. So, you are not at stake in this life. Really. And the most inept attempt to try to verify this will bear fruit. By that I mean, no matter how good or poorly you are at using your attention, at using the power of the mind to look at one thing instead of another, which is, of course, what we do when we're trying to create an identity, no matter how good or poorly you do that, if you will just try, just right now, check into the case that you are unchanged, that there's absolutely nothing that has happened to you in your entire life that has had any lasting effect on you whatsoever. You are the same as you have always been. And in order to do that, of course, you must look at you. You must look at you. The heart of all of this, the background of all of this, the reality of all of this. And in order to do that, you look for that which has never changed, that which is not, which calls no attention to itself. That's you. And if you do that, and if you do that as often as you can, as often as it occurs to you, if you just make that one effort that has nothing to do with changing anything about the way the mind operates, that has nothing whatsoever to do with understanding any of this, that has nothing whatsoever to do with becoming a good person or a bad person or an indifferent person, becoming successful, becoming unsuccessful, has nothing to do with renunciation or or enlightenment or any of that, if you will just do that as often as you can, to the best of your ability, everything will come out right. Everything will come out right. So, I do the best I can. God knows I try. And I am very grateful to all of those who are in this adventure with me, in this amazing vichara, conscious vichara with me. I thank all of you for the willingness, your willingness to speak with me, to listen to me, to help me sort out what it is that I am trying to communicate to you. I'm just grateful to be here. So I'm done, I think. Your turn. And I guess you all know how to ask Carla to speak, and so I'll just wait for that. It's so good to be here with you.
Sarah calling from Chicago.
Hi, Sarah.
Thank you, Carla. Thank you, John. This is great. As usual. John, I'm so tired and my brain really hurts, and you speak of trying earnestly and trying as hard as you can. Is it possible to try too hard to see yourself? Can you speak to that a little bit?
No, actually, it's not possible to try too hard to see yourself. I can speak to that from personal experience. God knows I tried as hard as I possibly could try anything. My brain hurt. I felt like I was really stupid. I felt like I was doing everything wrong. I was disgusted, impatient, frustrated throughout actually many months of effort to be effective in this vichara. So, no, you can't. Of course, it's true that in my own experience, much of the frustration and weariness and all that craziness that went on, that you may be referring to, all of that was not so much a result of trying too hard to look at myself. It was the result of trying so hard not to look at everything else, if you follow me. It is unnecessary that you know, the whole thing about trying not to do wrong is, of course, the work of this belief. Whether it's the effort, and I'm not saying, I don't know whether this is true for you or not, but the effort to try not to do wrong, to not look at what you shouldn't be looking at, and instead to look at yourself and, oh my God, how in the world do I look at myself? I can't even see what I am, and all of that. That's all that the energy of that, the mind-numbing, heart-sapping misery of that, all arises from the same old, which is this conviction that I've got to do this right. And the fact is that if someone had come along in whom I had some confidence and told me in the midst of all that, it doesn't matter. You know, really, it doesn't matter. The earnestness I speak of, Sarah, is the earnestness in the moment of actually looking at yourself. It's not an earnestness to make that looking at yourself something permanent, because that can only lead to exhaustion and discouragement. And the reason for that is because that you are already seeing yourself. So the effort to have that be permanent is an effort to make the case what is already the case. And that is, for me, was the source of much difficulty, frustration, and brain pain. But in the end, you see, in the end, it doesn't matter. What matters is not all that. What matters is the moments when you are in direct, unmediated, undistracted contact with reality. And those moments you may not even know are occurring when they're occurring. That's the other thing about it. There's no, as I say, there's no fruit to the moments of success in the effort to look at yourself. There's no immediate confirmation. Oh, there I am. And the point of the vichara is not to change your understanding of what you are. It's not to give you a new understanding of what you are. It's not to reveal to you the truth of what you are. It's just to bring this medicine that is the light of you into the disease, which is the false belief that you're trapped here and at stake here. So even in my own case, the insanity that I enacted over months in trying to do the vichara, trying to be constantly doing the vichara, even that didn't matter in the end. It's not necessary, and you really can dispense with it, but it's not going to hurt you. Nothing's going to hurt you. Is that helpful?
That was so very helpful. Thank you so much, John, and I appreciate the efforts that you go to continually clarify and simplify your message, and I also wanted to say thank you to Carla. That's it. Thank you.
You can thank Carla for me. You're very welcome. Anybody else?
Don, calling from New York.
Hi, Don. How are you? It's good to see you again, or to see your green button. I can't hear you speak, however. Maybe you've got a problem. Okay, well, Don, we're going to move on, and if there is anybody else that wants to speak, and in the meantime, please try. I'd love to speak to you. Is there anybody else?
Travis, calling from San Francisco.
Hi, Travis.
Hi, John. How are you?
Very well. And you?
I'm doing particularly well. Thank you very much. I wanted to, first of all, thank you and Carla for all your efforts, as always. And then I wanted to share a small report with you to just check in and make sure I'm still on the right track.
Sure.
Well, I think every time I speak with you, I mention something about having some kind of clarification or something. Well, in the shower, it seems to be that that's where the vichara pays off for me. So I think I'm going to write a book called the Soggy Sutra at some point. But again, I was in the shower, and I think I wrote you an email about most recently trying just sort of honing in on this raw feeling of being that the vichara is targeted towards, and that you tell us to look at again and again whenever we think of it, or whenever it occurs to us to do so, or whenever it does itself. And trying to put this in the right words, there was a moment where I've been trying to look inside to find this thing that I am, and it just suddenly occurred to me, this sort of weird flip happened where it occurred to me that I'm looking at what I am, that the objects and the world just as it is, the wall, the water, the curtains, the sounds coming in through from the neighbors are me, and that this awareness is me looking at myself, and that this awareness never doesn't have a location. There's nowhere that I can go that it's not already there. There's nobody else that doesn't have the same thing. And that, I guess how I would put it right now is that I'm this raw meeting of reality looking at itself. And it was this weird experience. And like I said, I was in the shower, and there was just suddenly this click. And then I was like, well, wait a minute now. Nothing's supposed to change, right? And I reached out and I touched the wall, and it was just the wall, just the way it's always been. And just very, as you say, very ordinary. But this sense of being this individual piece floating around trying to find what reality is sort of got blown away. And I don't know. I think I'm starting to ramble, so I guess I'll check in there.
And what you experience is an effect of the vichara. The insight, it's an insight that is very sweet and very true as an insight can be. And it's very good that you say that you touch the wall and the wall is still the wall. And because the fact is that the oneness of all being, which is something that we so yearn for and so forth, the oneness of all being is contained as much in the hardness and separation between you and the wall as it is in the internal experience of everything being the same stuff and there being no separation. Now, what you're seeing, and this is interesting, what you are seeing in seeing that is what you're seeing everywhere as the things that are happening outside of you, as the trees and the sky and the people and the wall and the shower and all of that, what you are always seeing, always, always, is the vichara itself, because that's what the vichara is the endless arising of the manifestation of awareness, the manifestation of reality, the shifting, changing, kaleidoscopic show of the product of awareness, which is you and me in this world, and separation and no separation, and wind and water and walls and so forth. This is a gift. It's a movement of grace, if you will, which isn't a term I use very often. Of course, and it's a consequence of the weakening of this sense of yourself as a self-contained, vulnerable entity that's at stake here. It's natural that that would be the case, and the clicking, that clicking of insight, of course, that passes, and everything seems to be just the same as it always was, but from a whole different premise, a whole different set of assumptions, so that it doesn't have, it doesn't hold the sense of being threatening or promising. The vichara, the personal vichara, remains, and it is not. And I'm not trying to correct you because I don't really think you think this. It's the same as with me. You say things and they don't come out quite right. But of course, the vichara has nothing whatsoever to do with correcting any misunderstanding about what you are. It doesn't really have anything to do with finding the truth of what you are. It doesn't have anything to do with fixing the mind's way of looking at things or its convictions about things, its understanding about things, and so forth. It doesn't have anything to do with any of that. It just has to do with bringing this false belief into direct contact with the reality of you, knowing it to be you over time, so as to snuff it out. And all the rest of it, all that follows from that, and it will continue to expand and emerge and clarify. There's no, There's no finishing to this, you see. This is something I really want to say. The goal of the vichara has nothing to do with being finished. Nothing to do with being finished. There is no finishing. The vichara itself is in truth, it is the only and natural and irrepressible activity of awareness. That's what the vichara is. The local conscious application of the vichara to snuff out false belief is just a local application of the vichara. The vichara itself is the whole of creation. The whole of creation, which is everything whatsoever that you see and feel and taste and touch and think about, and the thoughts themselves and the physical sensations and the birth and the death, and that's all the vichara. There's no finishing to it. What is finished in the end is the false belief that has driven us for all of these, God knows how long we've been human and trying to escape from our human condition. That gets finished, and more quickly than you might think, and more slowly than you might think. And the other thing that gets finished finally over time is the illusion that there is some difference between the effort of the entity to free itself from this false belief by using the vichara, some separation of that from the whole of creation, which is the vichara, and which is ever, ever, ever arising and unfolding. So, I don't remember what your question was, but I hope I was helpful to you.
Yeah, John, you're very helpful, and you always have been, so I really appreciate the effort. And I guess the only thing, what else came to mind was just, I've been reflecting on also what seems to be changing in my life as over the last year that I've been working with this, and since I found you on YouTube, since I've been meeting with you, that the two things that I think that the most have changed is that I used to spend a lot of energy trying to hold on to all the pieces in my life that were important. Remember to do this. Remember who said what to that. How to act around this person. How to act around that person. And it seems to me that if I just don't bother with that now, that it still takes care of itself. I mean, my memories are still there, and when I need them, they'll be there if I need them. So there's been a lot of ease around that. And also that a lot of how I operate in my life in when I'm at responsible to somebody else, like for my job or for managing my Aikido dojo for my teacher, that for my Aikido instructor, that I walk around with a lot of fear that I will do something wrong and something horrible will happen to me, and I'll let my wife down and I'll end up in the poorhouse and all that kind of stuff. And that too has seemed to have gone somewhere else. That now when I go into my job, it's no longer drudgery. I mean, it's the same tasks, but I don't feel like I'm always in danger of being fired. And even if I do, you know, even if something happens and my job does go away, I'll find something else, or something else will come, you know, and happen. I can't say whether or not my complete fear of consequences in life has disappeared, but I can say that my fears about forgetting something or letting somebody down or winding up on the street all seem to have gone somewhere else, and I am very grateful for that.
Well, that's great good news, and exactly the kind of report I would expect from this work. I'm really happy to hear that, Travis. By the way, you know, I'm familiar with the shower venue for reflecting on these things. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Yeah, I remember your story once about an event in the shower. Thank you again, and I'll talk to you next time.
Vivek, calling from Cupertino, California.
Hi, Vivek.
Hi, John. Okay, so I wanted to understand a bit more about what you mean by being at stake here, and I may have misinterpreted what you said earlier. So the way I understand it, when I think of being at stake here, I think of worrying about the future or regretting the past or being discontented with what's present right now. I thought I understood you to say that that's the operation of the mind, and that continues even after the vichara, even after losing the sense of being at stake here. So I'm trying to reconcile those two, what it means to lose the sense of, or the underlying assumption of being at stake, while even though the mind continues to worry or to have fears or to regret things and so on. Could you talk a bit about that?
Well, what I'm saying is, the fact is that those particular psychological phenomena that you described just now, they don't last forever. But it is true that the mind is an apparatus that has taken its shape and the things that, and settled on the things that are important for it to concern itself with, and the vocabulary and the understandings that are pertinent to those things that it should concern itself with, like the things that you mentioned, and that this apparatus has a certain inertia, so that it may well, this is at the heart of why it is that the vichara doesn't produce an immediate clearing up of everything, as seems to be the promise of spiritual practice. It doesn't immediately rid the mind of its stupidity or its psychological fixations and so forth. These things have an inertia of their own, and the inertia is like you know, if you're pushing a child on a swing, and if you stop pushing, the swing will still continue to swing for some time, unless you add more energy to it each time in order to keep the swinging going on. The energy that's added to the kind of mechanical activity of the mind to protect itself and to protect what it imagines you to be, it doesn't imagine anything, but protect you and to protect itself and so forth. The energy that's constantly keeping that developing and fed and refreshed is the energy of this belief that you're at stake here, and that there's something to be afraid of here, and that there's something to be gotten that could solve all your problems here. Now, those activities of the mind, since it is a mechanical apparatus, that continues for some time, you know, like diminishing as it goes along. The actual duration of it varies with the individual, with the predispositions of the individual. But it's certainly the case that those mechanical fixtures that make up the mental apparatus that has served this underlying fearfulness and anxiety and conviction that there's something wrong and I'm in trouble and I'm at stake and I've got to keep an eye on everything and make sure I get it right. Those mechanical fixtures that have served that, they continue for a while. And lacking any addition of energy that is denied to them as that false belief is snuffed out, they just fade away. And new apparatuses or apparati begin to form, and new structures and so forth that comprise the mind as its understanding of its activities changes, and as the energy that drives it is uncontaminated energy of vichara, uncontaminated energy of realization. For you see, this life is the realization. This life is self-realization. And the as the energy is clarified and purified, the apparatus of the mind change and shift, and they become different, and they do different jobs. And, you know, they don't... It's not that all of a sudden the mind becomes all-knowing, or that the mind ever becomes all-knowing. It's limited by its limitations. But the fearfulness and the strategies and tactics that the mind puts into play to try to serve this feeling of being at stake, at risk, and so forth, those fade away. But it takes some time. Is that, do you follow that? Is that what you're asking?
I guess my conclusion from what you're saying is that this mind here has a fair amount of inertia around some things at least. And I was wanting to ask directly whether your mind experiences worry about the future or regret about the past or discontent and so on after these many years.
No, it doesn't. There's, I have to say that's not... Those impulses are gone here. But it doesn't make me any smarter.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think that definitely gives many of us hope. So I think I understand what you're saying, which is that the inertia lasts for a while and eventually it winds down. And even though some of it lasts, is continuing in my case, one symptom I've noticed is that although much of my life I had a great desire to improve myself and I read a lot of books and so on, that desire has just faded away. I mean, I can still read the same books for entertainment and enjoy them, but this feeling that this mind and body need to become better has kind of gone, even though other things like worry and regret might happen.
Yes, you see, that's exactly what I'm talking about, and that's exactly the way it happens. It's not a... Things just start fading away. Sometimes things have faded away before you even notice they're gone. So you keep up the betrayal. Everything turns out right. No one has done this over a long period of time without reporting success in one form or another. So thank you, Vivek.
Thank you, John.
Okay, anybody who else?
Don in New York wants to try again.
Hi, Don.
Hi, John. Any better?
Aha, that's it. Whatever you did, you should write it down.
Well, I have a very sophisticated state-of-the-art system here that my kids gave me. It's so high quality, I'd like to throw it right out the window. I mean, I can't figure it out. In any event, with regard to the shower thing, you know, ever since 1960 or so, I don't know why, I continue, well, you're about the same age as I am, I continue to sing the score of the old beautiful show West Side Story. My wife is used to it now, but when it started, I think she was ready to dial 911. I don't know if that's a spiritual experience or not, but what I wanted to ask was this. When I'm doing the vichara, when I'm reflecting, I come to a point where I realize, and I've said this before, I just really, even though you say you really can't do it incorrectly, I want to make sure what I'm doing is along the right lines. I think of myself as always having what I call this donness, which has been unaffected by any physical or emotional or mental activity that I've ever gone through, just as I assume you would have the jaundice, etc. My question is this, is that focusing in the right place? And secondly, what about this business about myself, which I see this donness as, being the same as yourself? I'm a little confused on that point, and I really hope you heard all this.
I heard it all quite well, and on your first, yes, the donness is exactly what I am asking you to be aware of consciously, to bring your conscious attention to, that very donness, which I often call you-ness, and sometimes call me-ness, and it is exactly the same as the johnness that resides here. The assertion of that aspect, that it is the same the same I-ness, the same ness-ness. The assertion of that is something that cannot be proven. The longer that you are actually in touch with this reality of you, this Donness, as you call it perfectly, the longer you are in touch with that, the more apparent that will become. Now, the thing to understand is that we are not always consciously aware of what we know. So that I tell you from my heart that you already know this, that just as it's the case that although I am asking you and everyone else to consciously look at yourself, it is just as it's always the case that there has never been a split nanosecond in your entire existence when you have not been aware of yourself. You cannot not be aware of yourself. The vichara is a concentrated effort to bring that which you are permanently aware of into the conscious mind. And just as I tell you that you are always aware of yourself, always, I tell you also that you are always aware of, you always see everything clearly. You always see clearly that this that you are is the same as everything else, that it is at the root of everything else, that if I look for the Johnness that's here, what I see is the same, not like a mirror image or another exact replica of what you see, but it is the same. There is no distance between the Donness and the Johnness. Now, there's no way to persuade you of that. There's no way to persuade anyone of that. There's no way to persuade anyone of the proposition that the cause of their problems is the false belief about their relationship to the life, about being at stake and on the line here. There's no way to persuade anybody of that either. But just as with that, as you continue the vichara, what you already see will become more consciously apparent to you as time goes on. And it is not what we imagine it to be when we read the spiritual literature, because there is no, in reality, there is no, if you think about it, the whole idea, for example, of non-dual reality is literally nonsensical. If there is non-dual reality that is in opposition to dualistic reality, then that's absurd. The reality has no problem with anything. Reality is actually the heart of everything, the same heart, the same as everything. The appearance of different Johnnesses and different Donnesses and different aspects of things, all of that is the product of the natural, inherent energy of vichara that is the only activity of awareness, this manifestation, this magnificent show of creation. So, I hope that helps.
I'll tell you, John, it's very encouraging. I don't need to be convinced of anything. I've been at this for a while, and this is about the only thing that intuitively, I knew from the beginning that it would be helpful. So let me say this from my heart. About a half hour ago, you expressed gratitude for everyone listening to you. Well, right back at you. You'll be hearing more from me. Thanks a lot, John.
You're very welcome, Don. Thank you. Anybody else?
Adrian calling from Canada.
Hi, Adrian. Are you able to speak?
Hi, everybody.
Hello, hello.
I put together a few sentences in writing because when I talk without preparing something in writing, I have this tendency to hesitate and make things very long and difficult to listen to, I guess. So here is what I wrote down a few minutes ago.
Okay, okay.
One thing that seemed to be a constant in my life, in general, but also in regard to my spiritual musings or practices, is an underlying fear that what I do is not good enough. I think you reassured me by what you told me personally, but also by what you told others, in particular today, during this meeting. I think basically you encouraged me to try to leave aside this very disturbing and probably counterproductive state of mind. Since childhood, I have looked up for authority figures, trying to validate myself. This tendency was carried over later on, in my late 20s, early 30s, into whatever spiritual endeavors I had and whatever practices I performed. Perhaps you, more than anybody else, made clear today and before that vichara, which of course I consider as everybody here a spiritual practice, cannot possibly go wrong. And as you put it earlier today, one cannot be inept enough to do it wrong. Also, I believe you said something like, basically something that boils down to the fact that you don't need to go through life with excruciating suffering and with struggle and with dark nights of the soul for vichara to bear fruit in the end, which basically means, among other things, that one doesn't need to live with guilt, with the sense of overpowering negativity that harms one and stops him or her in the tracks. It seems to me that what you are saying in a nutshell is you don't need to do anything in particular to be whatever you are. And what you are already is quite okay. Now, is it possible that I am, to some extent or in some way, misrepresenting your guidance? Is it possible that I am in danger to become complacent and passive? As you can see, my old fear that I'm not good enough is not so easy to overcome.
Here's the thing, I missed a couple of words, but I'm certain I have the gist of it all. I just missed two words in what you were saying, and I don't remember where they were. But here's the thing, Adrian. The purpose of the vichara, and although this goes... Well, I'm not going to say that because I don't know it's true. The purpose of vichara is not to make it so that your life does not become passive and withdrawn. Nor is it to make your life so that it is anything whatsoever. The purpose of many spiritual practices and many therapeutic practices is precisely to do work on the way that the life is formed, to do work on the persona, to do work on the way the mind operates and the false ideas and understandings that the mind has, so forth directly. That's not the purpose of the vichara. The purpose of the vichara is very, very limited. And because you are not. But the purpose of the vichara is to get right to the heart of what causes misery and suffering. Our misunderstanding has us with the idea that what causes misery and suffering is something about the way the life unfolds. Like, unwarranted subservience to authority, like passiveness, like not understanding, like all of those things, that, or you know, irresponsibility, or any of the things that we can look at in a life and say, that's the problem, that's what's causing me misery and suffering. My passiveness, my worship of authority, my feeling that I can't do it, my confusion about what I am, my all of that. And you see, I include in there the element, my confusion about what I am. The seeing anything whatsoever that happens in the mind as being a problem that's the cause of misery and suffering is itself false. But efforts to try to reform the mind, to try to change the mind so that it no longer is passive, so that it no longer gives too much authority to authority, so that it no longer is confused about what it is. Trying to reform the mind, trying to fix the life, trying to reform the body, based on the premise that those are the things that are causing me misery and suffering, that effort to try to reform the mind is a consequence, and arising from the underlying belief that cannot be seen, the underlying belief that I'm at stake here, I'm in danger here, I've got to get this right. I can get it wrong. I have to be sure that I don't make a misstep. I have to be sure that I don't fall in love with the wrong understanding or fall in love with the wrong person. Or I have to be sure that I am not too subservient to authority, but maybe willing to pay attention to authority. I have to watch all of those things. All of that activity arises from, is not causing you any misery and suffering at all. It is the misery and suffering itself. It is the consequence of this underlying belief that there's something about this life and this mind and this body and so forth that is threatening to you or can do you good. That belief is what I speak of as the belief that you're at stake in the life. And the eradication of that belief, the snuffing out of that belief, is the purpose of the vichara. What happens in the mind as that belief begins to suffocate from lack of oxygen, what happens to the mind, no one can tell. This is all according to the predispositions, the prarabdha of the individual entity that is this mental apparatus, this structure of manifestation, this structure that reflects the realization of awareness. All of that cannot be predicted, can't be determined, can't be nothing can be done about it. So that the the concern that the practice of the vichara, or that anything whatsoever that you're doing, might in fact create more of the negative things that you believe to be the problem in your life, is like a second or third order misunderstanding. Even that can't hurt you. And even that is not something that has to be done away with. And even that is not something that can be done away with. It's just part of the way the apparatus of that particular personal consciousness has constructed itself. What can be done, and what I am certain are doing, what can be done is to, whenever you can, look at yourself. That's all. To say more is to say too much. You just look at yourself. And when we wonder, well, what is that? What is myself? Where is that to be found? I mean, really. And I'm not speaking just to you, Adrian, but to all. Really, you know what you are. You know what you feel like. You know what the Adrian-ness, to borrow a construction from Don, what the Adrian-ness of you feels like. Look at it. If you don't know what it feels like, look at it. Look for it. Touch it. That's the vichara. It has nothing to do with reforming the mind. It has nothing to do with making the life look like anything at all or nothing at all. It has to do with ridding you of the true source of confusion, misery, suffering, heartache, greed, passivity, fear of passivity, all of that. You follow that?
I think your answer is quite crisp. It's not exactly the answer that I expected or imagined that I desired, but it's very crisp.
Okay, then. Please, and always keep in touch with me. Everybody, keep in touch with me. I want to hear how you are all doing. Is there anything else, Adrian?
No, that would be everything. Thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Okay, I think we're going to call it a day here. Boy, you know, I thought of something I was going to say to you, and it's gone now. Things pass through this mind at lightning speed sometimes. I love you all. I say that, and that's the truth. And I am pleased and tickled pink to be in this continuing conversation with you, in this continuing relationship in service of this force of vichara that in which we live and move and have our being. We have a whole couple of meetings in the afternoon here in Ojai tomorrow, so I'm going to let you all go now. This is the hardest part of the whole meeting, is when I say goodbye. I'm just happy to be with you. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you so much for your time. Carla has some things to say to you. Keep in touch. Let me know how you're all doing. Okay, goodbye.